You're listening to the All Caps Podcast, episode 18 for the week of Monday, June 29th, 2009. In this episode, I talk about Pirate Bay, gay marriage, and how to replace the institution of marriage, Al Franken, kids surviving airplane crashes, biopolitics, JCPenney catalogs, robot butlers, Russian brides, Simon Cowell, and Silver Spoon trains, and a whole lot more. For more information, visit www.allcapspodcast.com.
But what is best in life? The open step. Three thoughts. Falcons at your wrist. Wind in your hair. Wrong! Conan! What is best in life? Crush your enemies. See them driven before you. They hear the lamentation of your women. That is good. That is good. Think about
today. Hey! Hey! Hey, All Caps Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Tanner Hagen, podcasting out of Los Angeles. And that's right, there is no Chris this episode. I'm flying solo. I'm a lone wolf, a rogue, because Chris is incredibly busy right now. Doing a lot of things, including recording a new album with Right On Wagner, who does a lot of the music that you hear in the show, including the intro and outro songs. A part of that band that he's in, they're recording a new album, so amongst other things, he's doing that and just can't find the time to squeeze in to do the podcast. And he could podcast tomorrow, but I've got things going on tomorrow. So since we missed last week as well, I've just decided, god damn it, I've got stuff I need to talk about. And I know all of our tens of fans are really getting frustrated with the lack of content. So to make your work days, school days, commutes maybe go a little bit faster, I've decided to lend my singular genius to entertain you in this episode 18, the special lone wolf episode. And actually next week, episode 19, Chris is on the road driving from Arizona to Michigan with a friend of ours. And to fill his seat that week, we have a very, very special guest, our first ever female host. So I'll be hosting the show with a friend of mine from graduate school, and she'll be sitting in Chris's chair, so stay tuned for that one. It should be interesting. I know I received some comments from some of the listeners that, you know, you and Chris are exactly the same and you agree on almost everything. It'd be interesting to get a different viewpoint, so hopefully this next show will give you a little bit of that, and if anything, it'll just be interesting to have a female viewpoint on some things. So, I usually start off with a rant, of course. Almost always it's something I've had stewing, and this show will probably be bookended by rants, because I've got two on deck. But this first one isn't really so much of a rant as an idea I've had. So I come up with a lot of theories. It's what I do as a profession and as a person. And I came up with what I would term a brilliant, world-changing, transformative, revolutionary idea in a conversation with Chris over Instant Messenger recently. And this is something I'd been thinking about for a while, but I hadn't quite got the perfect idea down, but I just recently did. So I was at a wedding this weekend for a couple friends of mine. It was a nice wedding. But it got me thinking, because as part of their vows, they had this really interesting section that I hadn't seen before, where the officiant, and I'm not sure if the officiant wrote this or perhaps the people getting married wrote this, but they had a little section that was kind of a political critique embedded into the ceremony, where they're talking about how, you know, marriage is a wonderful thing, and it's great to be able to express this kind of commitment between two people who love each other. But we would like to see this extended to all people. You know, this is something everyone should be able to participate in, and it provides valuable benefits, and so on and so forth. And without explicitly mentioning it, clearly the officiant was talking about the gay marriage issue and how gay people should be married. And of course, the All Caps podcast supports this fully and thinks it's a goddamn fucking crime that gay people can't get married. And it's one of the most disgusting things about this country right now. And the people who are against gay marriage disgust me and are on the wrong side of history and will eventually be proved to be bigots. But beside the point. So, you know, I'm sitting there in the audience and thinking, well, this is kind of cool because there might be other people in the audience. You know, this is a non-religious ceremony, and I bet there were some people, you know, you have to expect there were some people with sour pusses sitting in the audience thinking, well, I really wish Jesus was being invoked here or something. But instead, you know, they pile on. So I was appreciating that part of it, but it got me thinking. You know, it's really, what they were expressing is the tension of politically progressive people who get married, in that you are supporting an institution which is so clearly designed as a heteronormative biopolitical mechanism of the state, as a way to endorse heterosexuality, a man and a woman, as well as a patriarchal, sexist structure of the woman being given to the man, you know, the man waiting at the top of the stairs and the woman being given by her father and offered up to the man as a property, you know, exchange of value. The woman is a commodity in the marriage ceremony. And the entire structure of marriage itself is, as people have argued, like Michel Foucault, a biopolitical mechanism. And what I mean by that is, the reason why marriage is so important to the state is because it facilitates the creation, through the heterosexual marriage, of children to be bodies for the purposes of the state, whether through the making of war, the, you know, labor and the creating of surplus value, or whatever it may be. Okay. So, and this is really what the argument boils down to, is people are worried about gay marriage disrupting this biopolitical mechanism. Whether they realize it or not, that's at the heart of the issue, is it presents a fundamental threat to the political structure of the country, theoretically, under their... And of course, this is all nonsense. And if gay people got married, it would completely be fine. But it presents tension to the heteronormative conceptualization of the nation. So, you know, I'm sure they're feeling tension. I know these two people, and they are political progressives, very, very smart people. And I know that they were like, well, we want to get married, but we have... You know, we feel bad. We have our gay friends in the audience, and we have these political viewpoints, but we still want to get married. Well, my perspective, and this is coming from someone who was engaged for a couple years, and that engagement was eventually broken off, and had to be kind of convinced of the usefulness of the engagement in marriage, but I was sort of pressured into it in some sense, in that my partner felt it was important, and she had been receiving a kind of societal pressure, which is often the impetus for women and men choosing to get married, is often the outside pressure of trying to fit into the structure of society. So my partner has been feeling this and said, well, we need to get married. And my argument was always, well, we already are married. This is just a kind of official stamp of approval and administration of benefits or something. You know, and I had these reservations about the process because clearly I just was explaining to you all about how I feel at its heart that it's kind of a regressive, conservative, and in some sense evil institution. And if I had my choice, as I do now, I kind of would prefer to not participate in it for those reasons. You know, but I eventually, you know, to show support for my partner, said, okay, we can get married and engaged and all that business. And, you know, the irony is that she was the one who broke things off, even though she felt she needed a commitment from me. Ha, 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 ha. Okay. Sorry, I'm taking a sip of my Hoegaarden beer, an amazing goddamn beer. But, beside the point, once again, back to the marriage thing. So, blah, 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 I don't like marriage. I knew the people that I went to their wedding didn't like marriage either, but decided to do it. I decided to do it. But my problem here is, shouldn't we be looking for alternatives to marriage? My suggestion is always, we can't, gay marriage and allowing gay people to marry isn't going to solve the problem. It's a band-aid on a gunshot wound. Because it still has all of this cultural and political, societal baggage behind it. So my suggestion has always been, we need to find a new system for people to get married. And I never quite articulated exactly what this could be. But in a conversation with Chris, I came up with what I think is one of the greatest ideas of our generation. And that is this. Instead of marrying someone and celebrating the wedding, what we should do instead is celebrate anniversaries. Okay? So what you do is you partner with someone and you kind of have a menu of political categories with which you are partnered with this person. Okay, I am in a civil union. I am in a domestic partnership. I am in a child rearing whatever the bullshit, okay? So you still have benefits afforded to you and you can kind of choose from a menu of these benefits. But then in terms of our cultural celebration of it, we would translate it into a kind of anniversary celebration. So, my suggestion was you have a 2-year celebration, and then maybe a 5-year celebration, and then a 10-year, and then a 15-year, and so on. And accordingly, with those various milestones, the celebration might get larger and more significant as you pass through these kind of tests of life. And this solves a million issues. First of all, it multiplies the amount of parties you have. I mean, it's a huge win in that sense. So I know one of the big deals is a lot of people want a huge celebration of their love for each other. Well, you get a bunch of them through this route. Secondly, because it kind of exponentially increases, there's a kind of incentive for staying with somebody. Oh, we've almost made it to the 15 year and we'll celebrate it then. Okay. Thirdly, it removes the pressure of divorce. It's like, well, we didn't make it to our 5-year. Instead of this big, our marriage is broken down, you took those vows to me, you said you would never, blah, blah, blah. It's more like, well, we made it through 10 years, baby. It was a good run, you know? And then for the attendees, you know, for the... There's people like grandmas and grandpas fucking love this stuff. Everyone else, it's kind of like, well, it's nice. Close friends, it's great. So the people on the periphery wouldn't need to participate until the coupling has proven itself to have some longevity. And, you know, they wouldn't need to participate until that longevity is proven. But then the people who are really close to the people and love it would be all along on all the stages participating in this ride and offering presents and really celebrating it. They'd love that, okay? It's a win-win for everybody. What else? It's cheaper. You don't have this huge event. And the pressure's off in terms of the planning of the event. So with the incremental build in these anniversaries, you can kind of, they'll be coming up a long way in advance, and you can kind of save up, and it wouldn't cost that much money early on, and it would increase in money as you're making more money throughout, okay? I mean, think about this. It is truly the perfect solution. And I know in my situation, it would have helped out quite a bit, because as with all, couplings, I think, most, at least, I would hazard to guess, there is this common tension within the coupling, the partnership, okay? And that is, oh, you don't show enough affection, or you aren't as invested as me, or you need to show a sign of commitment, or blah, 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 blah. There's always one person feeling like the other one isn't as into it as the other, or something like that, or this kind of latent insecurity. I've talked to a lot of people, and a lot of people, I think, explain that. And this system, which I will call the Tanner Higgin anniversary wedding solution, solves that problem. Because say we install this 2-year celebration, that then is that sign of commitment that the other person needs, because you are participating in the ceremony, and maybe it forces people like me, who have a hard time expressing themselves, to maybe express themselves in a public forum, and it kind of implants some things in the partner's brain, blah 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 blah. So it's like a safeguard, in a way. Anyway, I've gone on for 17 minutes about this. But you see, so this is why this podcast was a necessity, because I had so much to talk about. Anyway, we'll stop it there. I'll be back with some news stories. Okay, so I would be remiss to talk about the biggest news story of the week, which is, of course, Michael Jackson passing away. And I've been noticing it's creating a polarized reaction, which is no big surprise, given that he's a kind of polarizing figure. You know, there is the incredible outpouring of shock, support, and love for Michael Jackson, and then there is the cynical, well, he's a pedophile, we can't forget about this, he was a sick person, and all of you who are celebrating him are kind of being silly and conveniently omitting this part of his life, or whatever. And I'm kind of in the middle ground of this. But first of all, he is one of the most fascinating celebrities of all time. Without question, he is. And it is because of this transformation that he underwent. And clearly it was a transformation facilitated by a severe mental sickness, illness, deficiency, whatever it may be, probably a product of an incredibly abusive, manipulative, exploitative circumstance when he was really young. And in that sense, the things that he did later in life, while they can't be excused, have to be understood within that kind of sphere of abuse, which makes him a really tragic kind of figure. But like I said, you can't excuse it, but you can kind of begin to realize where it was coming from. But to me, allowing that to pervert his what was and cannot be denied a true artistic genius, I think, is a disservice. You know, there's a long history of artistic geniuses who were perverts or unlikable people. And the reality is that the art can kind of transcend that in some way, because the beauty of art, which is a strange choice of words for someone like Michael Jackson, but the beauty of art is that it is an expression of an individual in all of their flaws and amazing attributes and everything. It's all the great thing about art is that it is all of that. Okay, so you have someone like Lewis Carroll, who was most likely a pedophile, and the character of Alice was a young girl that he took pictures of and clearly had some kind of romantic interest in. But then he gives us Alice in Wonderland, okay, which is a product in some sense of his pedophilia, but is also this amazingly imaginative work. So while you can't separate the author from the work, it does have a life of its own, and his troubled past makes that, and troubled worldview and perverted perspective makes it all the more fascinating, because it's offering us different perspectives of our world and the human beings that live in it. Okay, so to allow what Michael Jackson's crimes to cloud his artistic genius, I think, is doing our world a disservice in some way. And let me say this about Michael Jackson. He is an incredibly rare talent in that he literally created an artistic style. There are very few people who come along who do this. Particularly in music. He innovated in an incredible way. And I had always recognized this, but it really hit me when I heard Sheryl Crow, who used to be a backup singer for Michael Jackson, mention this. You know, they were asking her about, was he, you know, how was he strange, or, you know, blah, 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 trying to get at, you know, the tabloid stories of Michael Jackson. She was, and her point was basically that he was just an incredibly talented person. And, you know, I posted a blog entry showing his performance at the Motown 25th anniversary, where he did the famous performance of Billie Jean and kind of debuted the moonwalk. And my friend Eric posted about, well, it was the greatest lip sync of all time, pointing out that he was clearly lip syncing. But the thing is, Michael Jackson could sing live. He was an incredible singer, and he did sing live quite often, but he had this mental illness, this stage fright, this anorexia, this, you know, he was warped by his being shoved as into public spectacle in a way. And, you know, I always criticize when people lip sync live, but with him, it's just part of it's part of his persona in a way, and I don't let it disrupt the fact that his voice, his style of singing, the rhythm to his voice, the songs he wrote, okay, and sang and performed, the way he performed, his style of dancing, all of that was brand fucking new. You know, it came out of the ether. And someone like Justin Timberlake or Usher are so clearly indebted to what he innovated that I think you can't be forgotten. And even though he descended into what was most certainly a form of madness, we can't forget his artistic contributions, I think. So, in the rest of the news, first up, Simon Cowell has been making $36 million a year for American Idol alone, for doing what everyone on their couch is already doing, which is telling people without much talent that they're not very good. But, I mean, to his credit, he is the only good part of that show, and he's the reason why that show is successful. But he was making $36 million. He has now been offered, get this, $144 million per year to do that shitty job. I don't know what job you do out there, but I guarantee the labor expended, the brain power expended, the talent it requires is more than what Simon Cowell does a few times a week, a few months out of the year for $144 million. I did the math. I make shit as a college teacher. I make something a little bit over $20,000 or something ridiculous like that. Simon Cowell makes double what I make a year every single fucking day. He makes double what I make a year every day of his life. And he's most likely not working on the day that he's making that money. It's just incredible. And I'm sure he doesn't feel the burden of that money. I mean, could you imagine the burden of making that wealth and then... I at least I know I'd be thinking, God damn, I've got to do something with this money. I've got to like give to charity. I've got to make people's lives better. I'm taking so much more than I'm producing. I'm not worth this. I'm sure he sleeps completely fine at night. But of course, if I was making $140 million a year, I would splurge. Number one, robot butler a la Rocky. I don't know which Rocky. Well, one of the Rockies, man, they had a robot butler, and that changed my life. And I remember we'd get the, I don't know if all of you out there had JCPenney, but it's like a, what do they have out in California here? Gottschalk's, which is going out of business. Hudson's isn't even around. JCPenney's kind of like a Sears or something, but it's like a department store. This shows how little I go to malls. I don't even know what they have in California that's the equivalent. But it was a department store, and we'd get every Christmas, we'd get the JCPenney catalog. And when I was a kid, this was like an event. Like, seriously, my mom would inform us that it had arrived, and I and my sister would leaf through it. And I remember in the very back was the toys, and they would always have, you know, they'd have the action figures, things that you could possibly afford. Then they would have the crazy things you could never get. Like, you know, most likely a Power Wheel was out of your parents' price range, or an electric guitar or something. And part of that out of the price range thing was robot butlers. And naturally, these things, I'm sure, were capable of jack shit, since they were just like trash cans on a pair of tank treads. You know, about a foot tall with a remote control, and they'd show like the refrigerator open and the robot butler with a tray on it with a glass of soda with ice or something, as if the robot butler opened the fucking fridge, took out a can, cracked the can open, grabbed a glass, poured the... all of this would have had to have been done by your parents or something, and then all you could do was press forward on the robot butler as it would probably eke forward, spill the Coke everywhere, and then run out of batteries before it even got near you. But believe me, the fantasy of the robot butler alone was amazing. So, yeah, if I had a ton of money, I'd get a robot butler. I don't care how much research money. If you're Simon Cowell, you have $140 million in 1 year, you can afford to make a badass robot butler. What else would I get? I would definitely get the train from Silver Spoons. That would be going around my house so I could travel through my house on a train. That would make going to get a Hoover Garden out of my fridge more exciting. A Russian bride, definitely. Or at least a plane ticket to evaluate Russian brides. Yeah. I'm a man, you know, there's not much I really need, just those three things, and I'll be set. Okay, so what else was in the news? Michael Jackson, Simon Cowell, Al Franken was just declared the winner of the Minnesota Senate seat, finally, over Norm Coleman, who was just, would not let go. And this officially, I think now the House and Senate have a majority that can't be filibustered. So if Obama had any money, he could do some amazing things like pass healthcare legislation. But, yeah, it might be more of a kind gesture than anything that'll really happen. But so congratulations to Al Franken, who frankly scares me. Ever since his Stuart Smalley character on Saturday Night Live, the guy is frightening to me. I just get an uneasy feeling from him and don't really trust him, but good luck, Minnesota. But I mean, what's really fascinating about that story is it really came down to 225 votes, and it really, really annoys me when I hear people say, oh, my vote doesn't count. When you look at, this was a senatorial race that was decisive in that it shifted the Senate to a Democratic power base, and it was decided at 225 votes. 225 votes, that's like the size of your Biology 100 lecture at college. I mean, that's insane. So I don't want to ever hear anyone say their vote doesn't count anymore. And on top of that, I don't want to hear anyone say this ridiculous opinion that, oh, Democrats and Republicans are the same. Look back to fucking 2000, you moron. If Al Gore had won in 2000, do you know how different this goddamn, not the country would be, but the world would be? Okay, so I don't want to hear that bullshit either. Vote, goddammit. Okay. Next up, child survives Yemeni jet crash. So this is the second Airbus 310 in, let me see here, in a month. The second Airbus in a month that has crashed in the goddamn ocean. Okay. So this giant jet crashed, 153 people aboard, crashed in the Indian Ocean. It looks like everyone died except for one 14-year-old boy in the ocean. This kid survived a crash. The only one out of 153 people. I mean, it's an absolutely incredible story. I cannot wait. You know, it's unfortunate that it's not an adult, so we can't exploit the hell out of him and get his story and paste him everywhere and get his reaction. You know, it's going to have to be filtered by his parents. But I cannot wait to hear this kid's story. What that was like and how in the hell he survived without superpowers. And on top of it, in the goddamn ocean. So I'd imagine he probably found some kind of flotation device or something. But it's just incredible. I can't imagine myself at 14 years old going down in a jet and then having to survive alone with everyone dead around me amidst this wreckage alone in the ocean. It's an absolutely incredible story, but it also makes you think about these Airbuses. And the Airbus that crashed was already identified as faulty in some sense. It was due, and it was already undergoing extra inspection, was due for a kind of review, and was still flying in the air. So that's that doesn't bode well for the airline, needless to say. But you know, I was talking with some people at that wedding actually, and whenever I'm flying, there's always this moment that I think, holy shit, I am in a tube of metal thousands of feet above the surface of the earth, flying at hundreds of miles per hour with other people. I mean, we don't properly recognize how absolutely goddamn incredible flight is. Like when you're walking around outside and you see an airplane in the sky, can you imagine taking someone Bill and Ted style in a fucking phone booth from the 1600s and pointing to them in the air and saying there's people in that thing, dude? Their head would explode. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that kind of stuff that you, every day, you sort of miss. Like fucking garbage disposal. You put food in a hole in your sink and it disappears. I mean, it's incredible. Yeah. Well, anyways, think about that stuff. So the last news story I want to go over is the Pirate Bay, which is at thepiratebay.org, is a BitTorrent site. You know, one of these places where you download these files that connect you peer-to-peer to other people to download really fast, like music and movies. And the Pirate Bay has long been the source for these torrents. And it was just announced that Global Gaming Factory X, who is listed on the Swedish stock market, so is a public company, has purchased our beloved Pirate Bay. And the Pirate Bay for a long time was this kind of bastion of freedom on the internet, you know, and freedom in quotation marks, because what they do can be construed as illegal in a lot of ways. But they had always fought very strongly for their autonomy, and now they have fallen. And that's a huge sign, the kind of changing of the guard in a way, because they were really the most vehement defender of BitTorrent and peer-to-peer and doing this thing on their own, and this should be ran by the people for the people. Okay, but now they've been bought. I think it was for $7.8 million, it looks like, and they're completely restructuring the Pirate Bay. So they're not going to be using the Pirate Bay servers. They're not going to have their own dedicated tracker. It's all kind of getting distributed and whitewashed and made appropriate, and they've already been talking about monetizing it. So I'm sure the owners of the Pirate Bay are saying it won't be a huge change, but it certainly will be. But time will tell. This doesn't have the same impact that like the fall of Napster did. I mean, Napster was incredible. It ruled my dorm. When Napster was at its height, everyone was using it. And you know, the Pirate Bay is more kind of for the digerati in a way. You know, only the people that are in the know use the Pirate Bay, but they were the kind of successor in a lot of ways for Napster. And now they're gone. So all that traffic, well, not gone, but restructured. So pour one out for the Pirate Bay, all of you BitTorrent fans. Let's see. Well, I'm kind of at a crossroads here. I've got other stuff to talk about, but it's just me. I don't know how interested you people are in just hearing me bullshit. for 40 minutes, and I'm dying to talk about online dating and hobby dating, but I'm thinking it might be best saved as a kind of cliffhanger for next week's podcast. Yeah, I think that will work better. So what I'll do is I'll leave you with this cliffhanger. Next week's podcast with our special female guest will include a wild card segment, I think. Well, I think this is how I'm going to do it. It'll probably be our wild card segment, but it might be the rant segment. We'll include my experiences in online dating. So I know that's got a lot of your ears perked and should build some interest, but don't get too excited because it's not that all that exciting. It's really just, once again, me having a lot to bitch about. So I'll be doing that, and I've been kind of teasing how I've been wanting to rant about hobby dating. That is all part of this. But maybe we can even get our female guest to evaluate me as a dater. So we'll see. Stay tuned. Be back next week. Please check out our friend's web series, Paranormal Burbank. ParanormalBurbank.com. Chris and I wrote a 2-episode arc on their web series, which is a comedy web series about ghost hunters. It's called The Case of Fauntleroy's Folly. So if you go on their website, you can watch the episodes we wrote. And please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and review us, because that's how I guess you build traffic with podcasts. And damn it, tell your friends about it. Spread the word. We haven't been very diligent about reminding people to do this, because really there's no way to publicize podcasts other than word of mouth, really, and through iTunes' weird algorithm. So it's up to you. If you like the podcast, let your friends, colleagues, coworkers know about it. We'd appreciate it. Okay, see you next week. Hands in my pockets on the Alhambra shore. The Arcadia Fun World looks like a distant dream. Sipping a drink that will slip me across this world. Let's save the planet.